It's that time again. Let's take a look back at the week that was in NPR movie coverage. This week, Kin Turan on Leonardo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe. We'll hear from two film critics with lots of experience watching and making movies. Director Jonathan Demme talks about his new film and Manic Pixie Dream Girls. Stay tuned to learn more about them. But first, Groucho Marx on economic distress from another time that sounds very familiar.
The Marx brothers and Karl Marx have little in common except their last name. Groucho, Chico, Harpo, and Zeppo promoted comic anarchy, not the political kind. But according to critic Bob Mondello, one of their greatest films does skate through some economic territory.
Duck Soup, the Marx Brothers comedy made in 1933 at the height of the Great Depression, begins with an economic bailout.
Gentlemen, I've already loaned Fredonia more than half the fortune my husband left me. I consider that money lost, and now you're asking for another $20 million.
That's Margaret Dumont as Mrs. Teasdale, a wealthy widow who's been approached by the extremely unpopular government of Fredonia for a reason.
With $20 million in the treasury, we can announce an immediate reduction of the taxes. That's all that the people are asking for.
That's right. The government's prescription for the economic crisis is a tax break. Mrs. Teasdale insists on regime change first, and her candidate? A guy with a painted-on mustache named Rufus T. Firefly.
The last man nearly ruined this place. He didn't know what to do with it. If you think this country's bad off now, just wait till I get through with it.
Groucho Marx proving hugely popular, though his tax reforms probably wouldn't be.
The country's taxes must be fixed, and I know what to do with it. If you think you're paying too much now, just wait till I get through with it.
As you might imagine, Rufus T. Firefly isn't all that clear on how an economy works, which doesn't stop him from proposing solutions. His first thought is to try borrowing from foreign governments.
Now, how about lending this country $20 million, you old skinflint?
$20 million is a lot of money. I shall have to take that up with my Minister of Finance.
Well, in the meantime, could you let me have $12 until payday?
$12?
Don't be scared. You'll get it back. I'll give you my personal note for 90 days. If it isn't paid by then, you can keep the note.
Understandably, no one will lend him money, so he calls a cabinet meeting to examine other options.
Here's the Treasury Department's report. I hope you'll find it clear.
Clear? Why, a four-year-old child could understand this report. Run out and find me a four-year-old child. I can't make head or tail out of it.
The Depression-era writers of Duck Soup could joke about this stuff because after 3 years of economic crisis, every member of the audience would get the joke. And later audiences confronting similar situations have gotten it, too. In Argentina, for instance, when a military dictatorship wrecked the country's economy after a coup in 1976, they deregulated banks and industry, watched living standards decline, and borrowed at high interest rates, creating a record foreign debt. Finance ministers, as you might expect, came and went rapidly.
We've got to start looking for a new treasurer.
But you appointed one last week.
That's the one I'm looking for.
Intriguingly, every time a new Argentine finance minister got sworn in, long lines would form at a movie theater in downtown Buenos Aires. The management of the Lorca Cine had a well-worn print of Duck Soup, and they would cancel whatever else they were showing so people weary of groaning about real economic woes and the stumble bums who'd caused them could laugh at the ones on screen.
You give up that silly peanut stand, and I'll get you a soft government job. How would you like a job in the mint?
Mint? No, no. I don't like a mint. What other flavor you got?
These days, multiplexes don't have house prints of Marx Brothers movies, but Saturday Night Live and The Daily Show fill the gap. And Duck Soup is always rentable if you want to be reminded that folks were still cracking wise about 30s financiers, even after their stock market had plunged 89%. If your name's not Bernanke, you may well find that comforting. I'm Bob Mondello.
It's easy to identify the big film out of Hollywood this week. It's the one that stars Leonardo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe in a story of spies and terrorism. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan reviews Body of Lies.
Body of Lies is a film in disguise, which is not necessarily a bad thing, except in this case, the disguise is better than what it's covering up. Body of Lies details the life and death conflicts a CIA agent in the Middle East, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, has with his handler in Washington, D.C., played by Russell Crowe. When they argue about a shadowy figure in Lebanese intelligence named Hani, listen to how they get on each other's nerves.
Want to go and get a hot dog?
How do you expect me to operate, huh, Ed? What are you keeping all the cards to your chest?
What about an ice cream?
All Hani wanted was patience, Ed. Patience, not as a personal quality.
I don't care what Hani wanted.
Not as a personal quality, but as an operational requirement. You can't do it, huh? I thought Hani wanted to kill me.
Oh, don't exaggerate.
Honey don't want to kill you.
He likes you.
And who is he going to get over there better for him than you? Nobody.
This conflict underlines the way these characters are the twin poles of the film's moral universe. The most appealing is DiCaprio's CIA ace on the ground. He speaks Arabic, and he values human life, even though he's prepared to take it if necessary. Which is more than you can say for Crowe's devious Washingtonian, a smug creature of flabby immorality. Crowe gained 50 pounds to play the part. He shows once again that he's the rare major star who has a character actor's gift for submerging himself completely in eccentric protagonists. Body of Lies is directed by the veteran Ridley Scott, so it's always crisp and watchable. But once this film's disguise of atmosphere and mood falls away, what we're left with is a plot that's too unconvincing and conventional to hold our attention. Though partially set in Iraq, Body of Lies uses the war as little more than window dressing, as a convenient setting for a story that could be told anywhere and any time. Violence and deception are the name of the game. While dealing with Iraq directly would be commercially risky, it might have given this film the focus it needs.
The movie is Body of Lies. The reviewer is Kenneth Turan, who reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. You can find other movie reviews at npr.org.
And it's time to return to our occasional chats about DVDs worth renting. This morning, we've brought in two film critics who prove that YouTube is not just for teenagers. They call themselves the Real Geezers. That's spelled R-E-E-L, Geezers. These two oftentimes have very different opinions about the movies that they review, including the recent hit Tropic Thunder.
The satire did not play for me because all I could think about was that movie of Preston Sturges, Sullivan's Travels.
I didn't think of it once. Anybody who goes thinking they're seeing a meaningful movie, you'll be disappointed and surprised because it's a wild comedy.
Decades before they opined on movies, the Real Geezers helped to make them. Marcia Nassiter was a longtime Hollywood agent and also produced movies like The Big Chill. Lorenzo Semple Jr. has written many scripts, including Batman, the TV show, and Sidney Pollack's 6 Days of the Condor. This morning they're going to share with us some of their all-time favorites, recommendations to rent. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Except 3 days.
3 days. Did I say 6 days?
Lorenzo. The book is called 6 Days.
Yep.
But that was too many for the...
Couldn't fill 6 days.
Okay, 3 days of The Condor, 6 days in the novel. Let's get to your list of movies, which for some reason doesn't include 3 days of The Condor, but Yankee Doodle Dandy is on the list. What puts that on your list?
First place is Jimmy Cagney, who was also Public Enemy number one and a tough guy. And he was a fabulous dancer. He was a chorus boy on Broadway.
And here he's playing George M. Cohan.
M. Cohan, who was a writer, dancer, performer. And it's a very patriotic movie because it took place in 1944 and seemed a very appropriate movie for this time.
About a Yankee, that's all. Oh, me.
Little Johnny Jones, the jockey from the USA.
We'll ride the pony, Yankee Doodle, English Derby Day.
I got to tell you, you think of World War II era movies, something like Casablanca has obviously lasted. Some of the others seem a lot more dated. I guess this one is one that lasts, in your opinion.
Well, it lasts for me because it makes you cry at the end. Lorenzo hates for me to say this. I think movies tell you how to behave, tell you what to do. And can change people's ways of being.
Lorenzo Semple Jr., why do you hate for her to say that?
I'm a strong believer with what Auden, the poet, said. He said, poetry makes nothing happen. That's one of his most famous lines.
Oof.
I do not think that any movie has ever influenced anybody overtly. Now, if you set out to make a political movie, I think it has no effect.
Well, let's talk about a political movie, or what could be seen as a political movie in some ways, that made your list, Lorenzo Semple Jr., A Clockwork Orange.
Yes. It's a movie about a very violent English gang in a dystopian world of the near future, which could be about now. It was written almost 40 years ago. And there's an interesting reflection on the current Batman movie, The Dark Knight, because Heath Ledger's role of the Joker, he just wants to create chaos for its own sake. Well, in Clockwork Orange, Alex and his friends want to hurt people for its own sake.
This would sharpen you up and make you ready for a bit of the old ultra-violence.
The movie was treated sort of with horror when it came out. They gave an X rating, which was a kiss of death in a theater where nobody can go to it if they're under 21.
And it won the Oscar. And is that correct or not correct?
No, it's not correct, but who cares?
But Lorenzo, isn't it? No, I guess you're right. Okay.
But Stanley Kubrick, who made the movie, cut about a minute of it and got an R rating. But still, it appalled people at that time.
And now it's available on DVD.
In the original X-rated version.
And Marcia Nassiter, one film from your list here, is also described as satirical, but a very different flavored movie, Hail the Conquering Hero.
It's really my favorite Sturgis movie.
Preston Sturgis.
Preston Sturgis, yes. It's the story of a young man in a small town whose father had been killed in World War I. This movie was made in 1944. And he joins the Marine to be a hero like his father. And he has asthma. And he has to go back to his town, a disgraced American young man. And he meets six Marines who've just come from Guadalcanal. They take him back to the town because they say that he was really with them and he was a hero. And it's a movie I also cry at because one of the Marines doesn't want him to tell the truth.
You're home, your mother's happy. Did you see that look in her eyes? Your girl still loves you, and the town gave you a nice little reception.
I'll say they did.
Boy, I wished I was in your shoes.
Boy, I wish you were too. Look, I don't want to sound ungrateful. I know you did it for the best, and I thank you for your good
opinion. I tell you, it'll all blow over. Everything is perfect except for a couple of details.
They hang people for a couple of details.
Lorenzo Semple, Jr., did it make you cry?
No, it didn't. Somebody said about me, who knows me quite well, that I have the sensibility of a 15-year-old girl.
And that means you don't cry at movies?
Well, I do cry, but only at happy endings, at old Italians with a flower wagon in New York City.
Did the movie Sweet Smell of Success, which made your list, influence you in any way?
It was a great thing about the glamour of New York life in a very tough way. The story is very simple. Burt Lancaster plays a really dreadful gossip columnist in New York based very closely on Walter Winchell.
Want some cheap, gruesome gags?
You print them, don't you?
Yes, with your clients' names attached. That's the only reason the poor slobs pay you, to see their names in my column all over the world. Now I make it out you're doing me a favor?
I didn't say
that. The day I can't get along without a press agent's handouts, I'll close up shop and move to Alaska lock, stock, and barrel.
After the movie was made, it was a flop.
Then why have they stuck in our heads all these years?
Marcia, you know that the bottom line is what counts in Hollywood. When I say it's a failure, people didn't go see it, and it didn't encourage the studios to make more movies of that kind. Young kids today, they've never heard of these movies.
Well, maybe we'll teach them to go see
them. Oh, sure.
Listen, they're going to kick us out, Lorenzo. We'll spend the whole day telling them about movies.
Folks, this has been wonderful.
Great fun.
It's really
Thank
lovely.
You.
Hold on. Wait. I'll say this. Marcia Nassiter and Lorenzo Semple Jr. call themselves the Real Geezers, and you can find more of their DVD choices at NPR.org.
The new film, Rachel Getting Married, is getting rave reviews from many critics. Yes, it's about a wedding and has all the ingredients of a conventional movie. Young couple, worried parents, an assortment of guests, and the family black sheep. In this case, it's the bride's sister who swoops in for the weekend and disrupts the already frantic and tense preparations.
So are all of these energetic young wedding helpers staying at the house? Because after 9 months of constantly revolving cellmates and crazy people...
You weren't in a cell, Kim.
Groups. Well, I was sort of looking forward to a little privacy for once.
Kim is a recovering drug addict with major issues. The part is played by Anne Hathaway, best known for her sweetheart roles in such films as The Devil Wears Prada and The Princess Diaries. The man responsible for casting Hathaway against type and for bringing Rachel Getting Married to the screen is Oscar-winning director Jonathan Demme. Jonathan joins us from our New York bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here.
As a director, you are known now for your feature films, and many of them have had a political or socially conscious streak. You remade The Manchurian Candidate, for example. How did you end up making a movie about a wedding?
Of all the myriad strange ways you can get a screenplay, this, for me, takes the cake. I got a phone call from Sidney Lumet, obviously one of the great, great master filmmakers of American cinematic history. He called and said, Jonathan, hi, my daughter has written a wonderful screenplay, and I would like to send it to you. My heart sank because I wasn't interested in reading scripts at that point in my life. I was deep into the world of documentaries, but it's Sidney Lumet. So I said, well, thank you. Please send it to me, intending to call back the next day and say it's lovely, but I'm into other things. I read the script, and all those little parts of me that love working with actors started just waking up and screaming, you know, do this, do this.
Talk about the actors and the characters. We have Anne Hathaway as Kim, and the other main character is the title character, Rachel, who's getting married. And she's played by Rosemary DeWitt. And a lot of the drama comes from their conflicts.
Well, apparently she has a whole history of sexual molestation that we didn't know about.
What?
Kim, what's your sister saying? Did you say you were sexually molested?
It was a long time ago.
Were you?
No.
Why in God's name would you say something like that?
It was an anonymous exercise, and it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Did you want the audience to be conflicted in their loyalties toward these two characters? I mean, it's a little like taking sides in sibling rivalry and then switching sides.
As I read the script the first time and then again and again, repeated times, whose corner I was in was endlessly flipping. Going into the picture, I thought that I was more than anything on Rachel's side. I became more and more on Kim's side, though, because the more Kim brought the scenes that Jenny had written to life, the more I started seeing this incredible struggle that someone in Kim's situation is engaged with.
Raw emotion seems to require raw filmmaking. The movie is made almost like a stream of consciousness, and given the fact that you were working on documentaries, did that experience kind of dovetail with the way that you wanted to make Rachel Getting Married?
I've been working for the past couple of years on a number of different kinds of documentaries with Declan Quinn, very superb American cinematographer. And when I read Jenny's script, I felt like what we have to do here is to reinforce this sense of originality and reality. So it really seemed the only way to film it was like a documentary. And because we had so much confidence in this great cast that we put together, Declan and I made a deal with the cast that we essentially said, we're not going to rehearse. When you hear the action, you're not going to know what the shot is, because even Declan isn't going to know what the shot is.
Kim stands up at the wedding, and she gives this cringe-inducing toast at the rehearsal dinner.
Mm.
So during the 20 minutes or so that I was not in the hole for making a shiv out of my toothbrush, I actually did participate in the infamous 12-step program. 12 steps. Step will change, step will change. I'm still waiting for the change part. So, but you know, as they say, that relapse is an almost always inevitable part of recovery. So I get high marks in that mode.
Was that monologue fully scripted, and how much improvisation might have been done at that moment?
Kim's toast slash confession slash soul bearing is completely, to the word, scripted by Jenny Lumet. I still cringe as Kim gets herself deeper and deeper. No, that's a measure of Anne's commitment to the character, her grasp of the script, her commitment to the script, that she makes that speech so very much her own. Many people make toasts in that sequence, and one other toast was scripted. But the other people making toasts, those are toasts that the actors chose to offer to the couple.
The wedding, the party, I mean, I have to try and describe this wedding party. The men and women, women are wearing saris. You know, some of the men have the kind of Nehru jacket thing. There are leis of orange flowers. I mean, a samba group shows up at the reception. And during the vows, the groom sings a Neil Young song.
Yes.
She grew up in a small town. Never put her roots down. Daddy always kept moving, so she did too.
In Jenny's original screenplay, the song that the groom sings to the bride was actually a song by AC/DC, and we discovered that the price tag on that song was so six figures, our cast was cheaper. So I turned to my old friend, I love saying that, Neil Young, who is the author of, for me, one of the most romantic songs in the rock idiom, which is Unknown Legend. And Neil, very graciously, along with Elliot Roberts, his manager, gave us permission to use that song for three figures instead of six.
Hmm. Pretty good. Was Anne Hathaway immediately your Kim?
Yes. I had seen Anne in Princess Diary with my kids. It's a wonderful thing. I love actors so much that it's, for me, it's a very wonderful thing to see someone new and realize, wow, we've got another great American actor here now. And so when I decided, yes, I want to do this script, Annie was the first and sort of only person I thought of. Annie read the script immediately, said she thought both parts were great, but very much preferred playing Kim, I think, for many reasons, one of which is that it offered her the biggest chance to do something most differently. A year and a half later, there was Annie. You know, why do we sometimes have a fantastic sense of trust with someone? I don't know, but we did. We trusted each other every step of the way, and I'm very, very proud of what she's done here.
Jonathan Demme directed the film Rachel Getting Married. It's in theaters now. He spoke to us from New York. What a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Leanne.
There are certain characters in the movies that we always recognize. The mad scientist, the hooker with a heart of gold, the girl next door. They're types. Add to that list the manic pixie dream girl. She's a daffy, dazzling ray of sunshine. Her sole purpose is to enliven the hearts of those around her. You can see her latest incarnation in a movie opening Friday called Happy Go Lucky.
Yeah, I was just enjoying the silence. What's so funny?
I don't know!
That's the zany London schoolteacher named Poppy, played by Sally Hawkins. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, Poppy is just one in a long line of manic pixie dream girls.
The idea of the manic pixie dream girl came to film critic Nathan Rabin after he watched a movie called Elizabethtown. It's about a girl who perks up a mopey guy with her wacky, lovable antics, including an eight-hour-long cell phone conversation.
Then your ear hurt.
Yes, it does.
I have to get up in 2 hours and be charming.
That kind of upbeat ingenue was familiar to Rabin, who writes for the Onion AV Club. He'd seen her on screen in movies like Breakfast at Tiffany's, Amelie, Almost Famous, and innumerable other films, with young women crawling out of windows and jumping on the bed.
Like, that's what manic pixie dream girls do. They don't live lives, they don't have jobs or careers. They just frolic and have fun and imbue people with a sense of life's infinite possibilities.
Primarily, manic pixie dream girls persuade the hero to live a little.
Well, they kind of exist to help the protagonist. They don't really have a life of their own. They have kind of inner conflicts.
Exhibit A, Natalie Portman in the movie Garden State.
You know what I do when I feel completely unoriginal?
La, 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 la.
I make a noise or I do something that no one has ever done before, and then I can feel unique again, even if it's only for, like, a second.
Exhibit B, the flighty heiress in Bringing Up Baby. Katharine Hepburn goads Cary Grant's uptight professor into chasing leopards throughout the Connecticut countryside.
Oh, look, David, I lost my ear. I lost my ear. Look at me walk.
Susan. Manic pixie dream girls, they have no use for societal conventions. And men in these movies are like, they're, you know, working and they got a mortgage to worry about. And then these women just seem to exist.
Butterflies are free.
Every decade, says Rabin, has a manic pixie dream girl of its own.
The 60s and 70s, sort of hippie chicks fulfilled this archetype and sort of taught a lot of straights how to loosen up and have fun.
Hence, Goldie Hawn, a sort of professional manic pixie dream girl in movies like Cactus Flower and Butterflies Are Free.
They're love beads, and I want you to have them. They look groovy on you, especially when I fix your hair. Come on.
Some of us find these charming creatures irritating. Critic Nathan Rabin.
A lot of these MPDGs, as we call them, are incredibly divisive, where you're either like, wow, she's amazing, I'm in love with that character, or you're like, I want to strangle her in her sleep.
I can tap dance. You want to see me tap dance?
I would love to see you tap dance.
The manic pixie dream girl is a fundamentally dishonest character, says Rabin, a male fantasy of a playful girl woman who arouses creativity and uncomplicated joy. but she is an amusing muse. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.